This is NBC Nightly News, Tuesday, April 8th, with John Chancellor reporting from the NBC News Center in New York.
Good evening. It was reported from Washington today that President Ford has been asked to supply more than $500 million in military aid to be sent to South Vietnam as quickly as possible. The Associated Press quotes officials in the State Department as saying that's the recommendation of General Frederick Wyant, the chief of staff of the Army, who's just returned from Vietnam. Wyant said in public today that South Vietnam will fight on if enough aid is provided. A somewhat softer line was taken by Assistant Secretary of State Philip Habib, who said there is a chance that additional military aid could save the Saigon regime. Here are two reports.
The administration would like a lot more military aid for South Vietnam, but apparently it will settle for less. Enough, not necessarily to save the Saigon government, but at least to put it in a position where it can negotiate a political settlement rather than have to surrender.
General Wyant argued before congressional committees today that there was a chance to salvage something. He said the South Vietnamese are under heavy pressure, but they've not lost their will.
No question in my mind but that they will fight. They've been through a very traumatic experience.
Can they survive without additional USA?
No, they cannot.
With a choral background provided by a visiting high school group, Senator John Stennis said military aid could give Saigon negotiating strength.
If they make a strong military showing with some additional aid, then it's a question of what is North Vietnam willing to pay in military effort and expenditures and everything else that make a war. So they're willing to pay the price of emasculating these people, or would they give them some kind of terms?
So some congressmen, though not many, feel any kind of emergency military aid will help Saigon. Robert Goralski, NBC News, Washington.
At the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Assistant Secretary of State Philip Habib found the going tough trying to convince the committee that there is a chance for South Vietnam, provided it gets more military aid from the United States. The administration told the committee the situation there is not hopeless.
They do not lay before us any idea that they expect a collapse. My conclusions are that the South Vietnamese cannot continue as a viable state unless there is heavy additional military aid.
Is this Congress going to vote that aid?
I would think not.
I'm not about ready to give one more dime to people that can't stand up and fight for their own existence, and to a government that shows so little leadership and unbelievable amount of ineptness.
I think it's hopeless, yes. I think it's hopeless.
Both Democrats and Republicans agree that President Ford will have to be extremely persuasive over the next few days to get Congress to go along with more military aid for South Vietnam. Senate Majority Leader Mike Mansfield said that for too long, Congress has taken the easy way and simply voted more military aid. Now, according to Mansfield, Congress is ready to write the bottom line on that war and say that enough is enough, there will be no more military aid. Catherine Mackin, NBC News, at the Capitol.
Also on the program this evening, we'll see the plane from the South Vietnamese Air Force, which bombed and rocketed the presidential palace of President Tu in Saigon. We'll have a report on what happened today at the Washington trial of John Connally, the former Secretary of the Treasury, who's been accused of taking bribes from milk price lobbyists. And we'll check on the first day of Frank Robinson's tenure as player manager of the Cleveland Indians, a day which will go down in the record books as quite a day for him and for baseball. Those stories and others in a minute.
Forty years ago, family getaway cars needed all the traction, handling, and gas mileage they could muster. Fortunately, there was the Dual 10 from General Tire. Today, your getaway car needs even more traction, handling, and gas mileage. And fortunately, there's the 40,000-mile Dual Steel 2 radio from General Tire.
Sooner or later, you'll own Generals.
I smell clean. I smell clean. With Lifebuoy, I smell clean.
Hi, Daddy.
Hi.
Daddy, won't any soap get you clean?
Sure, but it's not enough to be clean. You gotta smell clean. That's why I use Lifebuoy. So, why smell clean?
Lifebuoy deodorant soap. It's not enough to be clean. You gotta smell clean.
Daddy, you really do smell clean. Now, where's my present?
It was quite a day today in Saigon. A South Vietnamese pilot attacked the presidential palace, and the police slapped on a total curfew for a few hours. Then President Tu, who was not injured in the attack, went on the radio to say, "I am determined to continue leading this country." Don Oliver was in Saigon when the attack took place, and here is his report.
It was about 8:30. Businesses in Saigon were just beginning to open. NBC News cameraman Shunichi Yasuda was starting to film a story on American businessmen in South Vietnam. Then he saw the F-5 fighter bomber as it pulled out of the first dive over the presidential palace. The plane made only two passes over the palace. One bomb hit 50 yards from the main building. Another damaged a section of the palace far from President Nguyen Van Thieu's family quarters. He and his family were not injured, but three other people on the palace grounds were reported killed. Fearing that a full-scale coup attempt was in progress, the president ordered reinforcements around the palace. Newsmen were not allowed near the grounds. There was no further attack. The bombing had been a solo effort by a South Vietnamese Air Force lieutenant, apparently angered because his family had not been evacuated from Da Nang before it was taken by the communists. President Tu's main political opponent, Marshal Nguyen Cao Ky, said he was not involved in the assassination attempt and knew nothing about it. Minutes after the bombing, President Tu ordered martial law in Saigon, a 24-hour curfew. Residents were ordered off the streets, businesses closed. The president urged residents to be calm, and he declared his determination to remain president of the nation. All military installations were put on alert. For a time, Saigon's Tan Sanhut Airport was closed. Many Westerners trying to leave the country were caught at the airport. But after a few hours, the airport reopened, the 24-hour curfew was lifted, and life returned to what passes for normal in the capital city of South Vietnam. The dissatisfaction with Tu comes from two sources. Those in the military who opposed his retreat from the Central Highlands 3 weeks ago and who are aghast at the lack of leadership in trying to pull the military together to defend Saigon. Others oppose Tu because he stands in the way of a negotiated political settlement with the communists. Quite a number of South Vietnamese believe the cause is lost anyway, and it would be far better to negotiate an end to the war rather than having Saigon overrun by force. But Tu stands in the way. The communists have said they will never negotiate as long as he is in power. So what happened today, the bombing of the palace, could really be just a prelude to a more serious attempt to remove Tu from office. Don Oliver, NBC News, Hong Kong.
That report came from our satellite station in Hong Kong because after he covered the story, Don Oliver carried the film to Hong Kong. The Prime Minister of Cambodia, Luang Boret, was back in Phnom Penh today after a journey to Bangkok. Officials there said he spent 4 hours yesterday in a meeting with the Cambodian Khmer Rouge rebels in what could be the beginnings of a negotiated settlement. And there's a report circulating this afternoon that Cambodian President Lan Nol, who is now in exile in Indonesia, will visit North Vietnamese officials in Hanoi within the next 10 days. More Vietnam orphans arrived in the United States today, nearly 300 of them, but there are indications that the airlift of orphans from Saigon will now slow down. And at a hearing in Washington today, Senator Edward Kennedy rebuked the Ford administration for not providing special aid to Vietnam refugees through the United Nations and its specialized agencies. Charles Quinn has more on the story.
One question Kennedy asked at his subcommittee hearing on refugees was why so many of the arriving orphans were sick, even though they came from orphanages supported by American money. He criticized American Aid Director Daniel Parker for not spending all the money available for orphans.
I don't know how in the world you can explain the condition of children that are in orphanages today that are under the control of the South Vietnamese government, in which the AID agency is indicating support, and not have come up here either to this committee or the Appropriations Committee with your hat in your hand and just saying how desperate these conditions are.
Mr. Chairman, the conditions in South Vietnam have been difficult and tenuous for some time
now. We're not talking about the conditions in South Vietnam. We're talking about orphanages.
I don't think that the condition of orphans making a through flight of some 10 or 12,000 miles when they arrive here is necessarily indicative of the condition in which they left. This is a rigorous flight. It's a flight halfway around the world.
You don't get...
I don't believe...
You don't get viral pneumonia, chicken pox, dehydration on an American plane in that period of 30 hours.
Kennedy asked Parker to tell Congress what he needed, how much money he needed for the refugees and the orphans. Congress is prepared to respond to this emergency, Kennedy said. Prepared to respond now. Charles Quinn, NBC News at the Capitol.
Senator Henry Jackson today said that President Ford has just discovered that the United States has made secret agreements with South Vietnam. In Jackson's words, secret agreements which envision fateful American decisions whose very existence has never been acknowledged. Jackson wants to call administration officials under oath for questioning on this. He made his statement early in the day today, and despite repeated attempts by reporters to get reaction from the administration, both the White House and the State Department have been silent on these charges all day.
I smell clean. Whoa! I smell clean. Whoa! With life, boy, I'm not just clean. I smell clean. Whoa!
He's gone bananas.
You know, getting me life, boy, was terrific. Now, one morning shower and I'm not only clean. I smell clean. Whoa!
Lifebuoy deodorant soap. It's not enough to be clean. You gotta smell clean.
Oh, hey, you really do smell clean.
UTA French Airlines introduces the vacation sensation. Tahiti. Sensational values in the Tahitian Pacific. Tahiti, Morea, Bora Bora, Raiatea, and Uahine. Airfare, room, sightseeing, and more. For the independent traveler, a Tahiti vacation can be even more sensational. Your travel agent has all the details. UTA's Vacation Sensation. Just ask for our Passports to Adventure brochure.
In the bribery trial of John Connolly today, the defense finished cross-examination of the prosecution's star witness, Jake Jacobson, a Texas lawyer and a man who was one-time friend of Connolly. Then the prosecution put on the stand a second major witness, Bob Lilly, the dairy industry lobbyist who says he gave Jacobson the money, which Jacobson says he gave to Connolly. Carl Stern reports.
Bob Lilly is the former dairy official who obtained the payoff money, but his appearance today did little to clear up whether Connolly ever got or asked for the money. Lilly testified that lobbyist Jake Jacobson requested the money, saying Connolly delivered on price supports and we're obligated to him. That point helped the prosecution. But then Lilly also testified to giving Jacobson another $5,000 for Connolly, money Jacobson has never accounted for. That helped the defense, which has been implying that Jacobson pocketed all of the money. The prosecutors then brought on a variety of witnesses, including a pilot, a room service waiter, and a phone company official, to verify details of Jacobson's story. Earlier, Jacobson, the government's chief witness, suffered another setback when defense lawyers asked him to sift through money he says Connolly gave back to him to conceal the first payment. 49 of the 280 bills were clearly too new to fit the cover-up story. Defense lawyers suggested Connolly could have overlooked one or two, but could he have made a mistake as to 49? What it all adds up to is the most inconclusive case the special prosecutors have had, although other witnesses are still on call for tomorrow and Thursday. What has been missing so far has been any proof of the movement of money by Connolly. Carl Stern, NBC News, Washington.
Hundreds of miners demonstrated in Washington today against a coal strip mining bill, which is now before a congressional conference committee. The bill calls for extensive conservation measures by mine operators. The miners think that will cost them jobs. So they demonstrated at the White House and on Capitol Hill, and they lobbied congressmen in an attempt to get the bill killed. Gordon Graham has more on the demonstrations and the provisions of the bill.
Norton, Virginia, like many communities in Appalachia, depends primarily on strip mine coal for economic survival. Norton is thriving now, but local citizens fear that a strip mine bill pending in Congress could turn Norton into a ghost town. The new law requires that land that has been mined be restored to its original contour. Miners say the high cost of such restoration would close down most mining operations.
We would be out of work. The unemployment rate here, the only place that we figure we could find a job would be in the unemployment line. That's the only thing we could see.
95% of the trucks in this area haul from strip pits. And if this bill is passed, it'll shut us down.
The proposed law would prevent miners from leaving ugly scars on the mountains. But it would also prevent the use of reclaimed land for projects which the current law allows, such as parks, schools, industrial plants, and other facilities which require level land. To dramatize their protest against the strip mine bill, the miners came to Washington.
The Strip Mine Reclamation Act has the support of environmentalists and the leadership of the United Mine Workers Union. It also has the support of large majorities in both the House and the Senate. So unless this demonstration causes a lot of congressmen to change their minds, the strip miners of Appalachia may have to start looking for work elsewhere. Gordon Graham, NBC News, Washington.
The Labor Department reported today that the typical urban family of four requires $14,300 a year to maintain what is called a moderate standard of living. That's $14,300 a year. Inflation has driven up that figure more than $1,700 in 1 year.
Want to meet the real life of the party? It's right here. Carrier's Roundland, the most attractive central air conditioning unit you can buy and one of the most efficient. Fact is, if all the others in the country ran as efficiently as this one, there will be enough electricity saved this year, we estimate, to power Los Angeles every night for 6 months. To find out what the Roundland can save you, call your Carrier dealer.
Here at Minnesota's Mesabi Range, we mine an iron-bearing rock called taconite. As it comes out of the ground, its 20% iron content is too low for steelmaking. But by crushing, milling, and magnetically separating, we upgrade the ore to 65% iron. By rolling this concentrate into uniform pellets, we're able to increase the capacity and efficiency of our blast furnaces. That's productivity. At United States Steel, we're involved.
For each coffee bean, there is only one day of perfect ripeness. So in Colombia, South America, harvest time is also a time of waiting. Today, Juan Valdez picked only the beans that were ready. Others he left to ripen in the soft breezes of another Colombian night. For Juan, there is no need to hurry. He is not growing the fastest coffee in the world. He is growing the richest Colombian coffee.
In Paris today, preliminary talks continued on a proposed World Energy Conference. The oil-producing countries worked out a program including a demand that not just oil, but all raw materials be discussed at any such conference. The Western countries don't want that, and the United States has already warned that a conference of that kind won't accomplish much. NBC News correspondent Robert Hager has been following the government's investigation into ways in which oil companies may have overcharged their customers since the energy crisis began. In a third report tonight, Hager traces the way in which cheaper foreign oil managed to become much more expensive foreign oil.
Government attorneys say the scheme involved several large companies, millions of dollars, and 75 or more tanker loads of oil sold to American electric companies last year and the year before. Sources close to the case say the companies bought cheaper oil from Algeria, Libya, and sometimes Nigeria, raised the price by calling it more expensive Venezuelan oil, and by trading it back and forth among themselves, finally selling it at big markups to U.S. electric companies through the ports of Boston, New York, Norfolk, Jacksonville, Los Angeles, and perhaps others. Government attorneys say the oil was bought in the Mediterranean, On the way across the ocean, it was traded back and forth among the companies three or four times on paper. Sometimes at sea, sometimes in Venezuela, the oil was switched from the original tankers to others to make it seem that the oil originated in Venezuela. Before the oil finally reached the U.S., it changed ownership once or twice more and wound up in the hands of the company that first bought it overseas. Federal lawyers say this original purchaser paid from $6 to $12 a barrel for the Mediterranean oil. But after claiming it as Venezuelan oil and marking it up for each sale along the way, the firm sold it to U.S. electric companies at $17 to $25 a barrel, double or triple the original price. No formal charges have been made yet, but U.S. attorneys say a federal grand jury in Jacksonville, Florida, is examining documents related to Shell Venezuela, also to the Venezuelan government's national oil company, to an American company called Coastal States, and to Venn Fuels, a subsidiary of the American conglomerate International Systems and Controls Corporation. Other grand juries are expected to convene soon in Los Angeles and here in New York. Robert Hager, NBC News, New York.
The Agriculture Department said today that food stamp allotments will go up in July because of rising food prices. A family of four now can buy $154 worth of food stamps. In July, that family will get stamps worth $8 more for the same number of dollars. Because of the recession, enrollment in the food stamp program is going up much faster than the government expected, and many of the local agencies which distribute the stamps are having trouble. Here's a report on that from Carol Simpson.
In the city of Baltimore, the people who run the food stamp program are desperate. So desperate, they've had to turn to armored trucks to get the stamps to some who wouldn't be able to get them any other way. It's always been tough to get through the government red tape of qualifying for stamps in Baltimore. But now, since the economy went bad, the number of people seeking them has doubled. Most of the new applicants are laid-off workers. A great many are white middle class. They've thrown the system into virtual turmoil. Banks and savings and loans sell the stamps in Baltimore, but only on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday mornings between 9 and 11 o'clock. They could sell them longer, but they fear too much time would be devoted to food stamps at the expense of other bank business. So those people who can't get to the bank do without. The director of the food stamp program is Mrs. Maud Harvey.
Then couldn't President Ford do something?
Oh, I'm sure the power, that's where the power is. The power is with the president and with the Department of Agriculture. You're absolutely right.
But she doesn't think the federal government will help. So the city has been sending armored trucks into areas where some of the neediest people live. The guards act as tellers and sell stamps to anyone who can prove he's qualified. There are two trucks operating now, and city officials say that unless the federal government does something about the red tape and the availability of purchasing outlets, they'll have to organize a fleet of trucks.
Did you ever try this mobile unit that's on the corner?
Mayor William Schaefer sometimes goes with a truck to act as advance man to let people know it's there. The mayor says the armored truck plan isn't practical. In fact, it may not work at all. But he says he's got to do something. Carol Simpson, NBC News, Baltimore.
Last night on this program, our diplomatic correspondent, Richard Valeriani, reported that Israel is considering making new concessions to Egypt in order to get negotiations going again. And today, that story was confirmed by other sources. The Israelis are said to be talking about a greater pullback in the Sinai Desert than had been proposed last month when Egypt and Israel were negotiating through Secretary of State Kissinger. But, as Valeriani pointed out last night, the Israeli cabinet still has to approve any new concessions.
When you spray paint, what you want is a beautiful, smooth finish without runs and drips. That's why I switched to Krylon. Look at this test. Krylon versus the other leading brand. See? The other brand is running, but Krylon's fast-dry formula helps you avoid runs and drips. With Krylon, even an amateur can get a professional finish. Beautiful. Krylon, for the beautiful professional finish.
What's that, Jack?
A second flavor of Digel. New lemon orange. Now there are two Digel flavors. At times, you know how tired you get from the taste of some antacids.
Oh, do I?
Not with Digel. In regular mint or new lemon orange. Both work like no plain antacid can.
How's that?
Digel is different. Relieves occasional heartburn, acid indigestion. Gets rid of gas.
Gas?
Gas pressure. Fullness. Digel. In regular mint.
And new lemon orange. I'll try it.
And finally this evening, a success story about a black man named Frank Robinson. He's a baseball player. And today he went to work as a player manager, the first black man ever to manage a Major League Baseball team, the Cleveland Indians. And how did the first black player manager in the major leagues do in his first day on the job? Well, as a player, he hit a home run. As a manager, the Indians beat the New York Yankees 5-3. Not bad. Here's a report.
...56,000 fans greeted Frank Robinson on opening day, but Robinson acted as though it were just another game.
Well, I won't have to perform any harder. My job is going to be tougher because I am playing, naturally. But I know that my every move is going to be watched and checked, where other managers second-guess, say, when in certain situations.
Mrs. Jackie Robinson, widow of Major League Baseball's first black player, threw out the first ball just before the Indians took the field to open their season against the New York Yankees. Despite the pressure, Robinson went calmly to work. In the bottom of the first inning, he came to bat for the first time and hit a home run. Joe Castiglione, NBC News, Cleveland.
And good night, all you sports fans, for NBC News.